Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to the Jazz on the Tube podcast series. Today we're going to introduce and talk with a very interesting guest, professional musician with a long and distinguished and varied career, who also has written books about his experiences in jazz. And I first heard about them from a subscriber who was very enthusiastic about them and said that I absolutely had to interview our guest today, who is Bill Crow. Welcome, Bill.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Hey, speaking of books, could you give us the titles of your books?
Well, the first one was called Jazz Anecdotes. That's a collection of stories about musicians that I gathered over a period of a couple of years. And then I realized when I was putting that book together that my own personal stories had a little different tone to them, and I had so much other stuff, I just kept those out. And when the first book was successful, I convinced the publisher I had another one, and that one's called From Birdland to Broadway. They're both published by Oxford University Press.
Great, great. And these books and books like them are so important. This is our historical record of the art form.
Yeah.
And we've got a section on our website called Chroniclers, and where we highlight and feature people that have gone through the significant effort of writing a book. I've done a couple, and I mean, it's heavy lifting. There's nothing lightweight about getting a book into print. And it's a great service to the present fans, but also future fans who are going to wonder, you know, there'll be a day when Charlie Parker is 200 years old. And,
yeah.
I mean, it's going to happen, we hope. And what are those people going to know? Are they only going to know the stories that people took the time to put down to paper? Hey, let me talk with you about your career in jazz. Now, you're from Washington State. Now, I don't think of Washington State as a hotbed for jazz. On the other hand, I'm pretty ignorant, so I may have missed something significant.
Well, I grew up in a town named Kirkland, which is across Lake Washington from Seattle. And being it was Depression days and we didn't have much money, we didn't get to Seattle more than maybe twice a year to go see the Christmas windows or to go to the zoo in the summertime, something like that. And so even though I was interested in jazz since I was in junior high school and had been collecting records and all that, I had no idea that there was a lively jazz scene in Seattle until I got home out of the Army and started living in town where I was going to the University of Washington. And I discovered that there was all these really good musicians around and a few places where you could go hear music. And actually, that was when I met Quincy Jones. He was 18 years old in high school. And Ray Charles was in town, although I didn't know his name was Ray Charles. Everybody called him R.C. And he had a trio and was trying to sing like Nat Cole.
Okay.
So it wasn't too much longer after I left town to come to New York that he had a huge hit and became the Ray Charles we all know.
I heard that, just to go on a little sidebar, maybe you know the story and can confirm it, but I heard that he had a long stay in New Orleans and that sort of changed his approach to music, which has actually happened to a lot of musicians.
Well, it was funny when I first met him. I met a girl that was working in a record store, and she came over and saw me looking in the Charlie Parker bin and said, "You must be a musician. Nobody else looks in that bin." And so I told her I was just new back in town, and she said, "Well, you got to come over to the Washington Social and Educational Club." That was a nightclub in the Black District, and she took me down there to hear Bumps Blackwell's quartet. And Ray Charles was the piano player. And he sang Nat Cole-type song during the set. And then this girl I was with hollered up, Ray, R.C., she called him. She said, "Sing the blues." So he sang the blues and just tore me up. I thought, oh, that's wonderful. So when she introduced me to him later, I said, "Man, you ought to sing like that all the time. That's wonderful." And he said, "Oh, man, where I come from, everybody sings like that. You can't make a nickel singing like that, you know." Somebody changed his mind. He grew up in Florida, and evidently he was singing not only with blues bands, but with country and western bands down there.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't a big surprise when he added the country and western tunes to his repertoire.
Oh, I see. Yeah, there's always a reason behind this stuff, if you just know the history. When did you get your training in music? When did you first get an instrument, and
My mother was a musician. She was a soprano. She sang church music and light classical music, and was in a couple of Gilbert and Sullivan operettas that were produced by the local town there. And she taught vocal and elementary piano. So we had a piano in the house, and I fooled around with it, and she started giving me lessons when I was about four. But I didn't really get along with the piano. I had trouble keeping track with both hands. So when I was in the fourth grade, we got a new music teacher in the school system there in Kirkland, and he saw that his senior band was graduating and not much else was coming up, so he started a program clear down through the fourth grade of anybody that wanted to learn to play a musical instrument, he would try to arrange something. They had some school instruments, and were the smaller instruments, they were able to talk the parents into buying them. So I marked trumpet on the sheet that he passed around, and my folks sent to Sears Roebuck and got me a trumpet. It was $9.95 with case. And I played that for 2 years, and then I complained to the teacher that I couldn't seem to get my lip to play high enough to play the first parts, which I wanted to play. I want to play the melody. And he looked at my teeth and said, well, you may never really have a good trumpet embouchure, but the school owns a baritone horn that nobody's playing, and it's a really wonderful instrument and has all the nice parts in the concert band. Why don't you take it home and try it?
Mm-hmm.
It fingered the same as a trumpet. So I took it home, and I fell in love with that instrument. I really learned to play it well. In high school, I got an after-school job and bought myself a nice King baritone horn. And I was going to solo contests and getting high marks and all that sort of thing, playing with the concert band. So when I went in the Army, I thought it would be easy to get into a band and play the baritone horn. But for some reason, everything kept falling so that I couldn't get into a band. The first band that tried to get me was leaving before my basic training was over, and they wouldn't let me go with them. And the second band was in the infantry, and I had taken basic training in the engineers, so they couldn't have me. And they put me in an office. They found out I could type, and they put me in an office. And it wasn't until I met somebody through the office connections who knew of a new band that was being formed that he just put my name on the list, and I was transferred to the band with no problem at all. So I met a cornet player, a very good jazz cornet player from Brookline, Massachusetts. And we both liked traditional Dixieland and Chicago jazz at that time. And he actually knew people like Pee Wee Russell and Muggsy Spanier and Frankie Newton and that sort of thing. So I was very impressed with him. And he got me to play the trombone parts on the baritone horn. And we would sit around and jam a lot. And then he said, well, why don't you get a valve trombone? That would be more a real jazz instrument, you know. So I found one in Baltimore. We were stationed out there. And that was what I came home out of the Army playing, was the valve trombone. But by that time, I had found Charlie Parker records and Dizzy Gillespie records, and I was interested in that music as well. So I met a drummer in Seattle who convinced me that if I wanted to be a musician, I should go where the music is. And we both got on the bus and came to New York.
Great. And how about maybe we'll talk a little bit about the Birdland part of Birdland to Broadway. For those of us that never saw it and wonder what was going on, what it looked like, what the feeling was like, what the shows were like, what the heck was Birdland like?
Well, it was a cellar space. You walked down a flight of stairs, and when you came into the room, on the right were tables and booths, and bandstand was in the center, and the far left was the bar, and between the bar and the left side of the bandstand, there was a section we called the peanut gallery, where you could just, there were just chairs there, and you could just sit there. You didn't have to buy anything.
Oh.
So for the admission price, I think when I first started going there, it was about 95 cents or something like that. You could sit there all night and listen to Charlie Parker's band, you know.
Oh, goodness. Nick, do you happen to recall your
time there?
I bet you did at 95 cents. Do you recall your first night there, the first night you walked in, what it was, you know, I'm just curious.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about it.
Bird was there with his band, which consisted of Red Rodney, Tommy Potter, Roy Haynes, Bud Powell. And then the house band that was playing opposite them, they would play half-hour sets or 40-minute sets. The other band was all guys that had recorded with Bird. So there was Max Roach, Curly Russell, Al Haig, Miles Davis, Sonny Stitt, and J.J. Johnson. And that was the house band.
Wow.
So it was like going to school every night. I'd just go down there and sit and listen to these guys. And they were such a magnet to the whole jazz world there that you'd look around the room and all your heroes would be standing at the bar or sitting at the peanut gallery or sitting at tables. So I got to see in the flesh people whose records I'd been collecting for years, you know, Lester Young and Joe Jones and Ben Webster and people like that, Oscar Pettiford, you know. So, well, the first summer that I was in New York, this drummer that brought me out here, Buzzy Bridgeford, got a summer job up in Tupper Lake, New York, way up close to the Canadian border. And one thing led to another. I went up to visit him, took my trombone along, and he talked the boss into hiring me for the summer. And then they wouldn't hire a bass player. He had drums, piano, tenor and trumpet, and then he added me as a trombone player. But for some reason, the boss didn't think that a bass player was necessary. He already had two rhythm instruments. So Buzzy went out and found a kid that owned a K bass that was willing to rent it to him for the summer when he wasn't using it. And I gave him $20 bill for the summer or something like that. And he put the bass on the stand and said, look, when you're not playing the trombone, you got to try to play this bass. And they could all tell me what they wanted to hear, but nobody could tell me exactly how to do it. I knew how to tune the bass. I knew what the string names were. But I had to figure it out on my own. And by the end of the summer, I had figured it out well enough that I could take jobs on the bass. But I didn't own one, so if I got a job, I had to go rent one. And then gradually, I accumulated enough money to buy a $75 bass. And I was on my way, and not much was happening with the trombone. So after a couple of years, I gave it to a friend whose tenor was in hock, and he traded it for the tenor and was able to take a job on the road. And then when he paid me back what he owed me, it would be like $3 or $4 at a time, and I would use that for food. So I never did rescue the trombone until somebody wanted to buy it, and I sold it to him, sold him the pawn ticket.
Okay.
And I let 25 years go by without touching a brass instrument until I got into theater work, and then they started asking for a double on tuba sometimes, and I figured, well, Jesus, that's not any more different than the baritone horn. I can probably play that. So I borrowed one and got my chops together and started making extra money as a tuba player.
On Broadway.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of work. People may not be aware, but if you think about it, all those pit orchestras, that's a lot of jobs, especially when Broadway was really booming.
Well, I did that for about 10 years, and it got me a pension that I never would have gotten just playing with jazz bands, you know.
Right, right. So you're listening to all these Charlie Parker records, and next thing you know, you're in New York City, and you're walking into Birdland, and there's everybody. Let's talk a little bit about your jazz gigs and things, people that you hooked up with and groups.
Well, the first thing I did was just hang around jam sessions and wait for the bass player to get tired so I could get a chance to play, you know. Mm-hmm. And I got to know a lot of different musicians that way. And then the word would get around that I was a bass player that could be relied on to play good time. And so Saturday night jobs would turn up. I think the first jazz jobs that I got were Monday nights at Birdland, was the off night. And I got a chance to play in there with George Wallington one night and with Bobby Scott one night. And then I met Teddy Charles, who had a trio he was rehearsing. He didn't have much work for it, but they rehearsed a lot. And his bass player was leaving to take a real job. So I started going over to Teddy's place every afternoon, and he would teach me all of the changes to bebop tunes. And he had a good guitar player, a guy named Don Roberts from Chicago. And the three of us had quite a repertoire of hot jazz. But unfortunately, he had a manager that was selling us to clubs that were used to having entertaining bands, comedy bands, things like that. And we would come in there and play all these Charlie Parker and Bud Powell tunes, and they didn't know what the hell we were doing. So just by chance, Jimmy Rainey had been working with Stan Getz, and Stan went to the coast by himself and didn't take his band with him. So Jimmy had the summer off, just at a time when Don Roberts got a job with somebody else, and Teddy had this little gig, a club on 46th Street. So Jimmy Rainey came and made that job with us for the month of July, something like that. And then I got friendly with him. I was living in the Village by then, and so was he. And I used to go over to his house quite often, and we'd listen to records or play a little. And then Stan Getz called him and said he was coming back. He had a week in Boston, and Roy Haynes was living up there at that time. So he was going to be the drummer, and Stan had a piano player. So he told Jimmy, get a bass player and come on up, you know. So Jimmy said, you want to do it? And I said, of course I do. So we got on the train and went on up there. I thought it was just going to be a week, but it turned out to be 6 months. The band kept changing. The piano player that we were using up there was a guy from Pittsburgh named Jerry Kaminsky, and he only made that gig, and Roy only made that gig because he didn't want to leave Boston. So the next job we had was in Birdland, and Stan got Duke Jordan and Frank Isola and me and Jimmy. And so we did a Carnegie Hall concert that week, too. That was really exciting. And then we went on the jazz circuit. We'd go to Baltimore, Philadelphia, and we came back to New York one time. We thought we had a week off, but Stan called me on a Monday and said, we're going into Birdland tomorrow night. They had a cancellation. So we went into Birdland. I saw that Kenny Clark was the drummer. And I thought, oh, Frank must have been busy, you know. So they always broadcast the first set on the radio, and we played that night. And the second set, I looked down, and there's Frank Isola sitting in the audience. And I said, Frank, what happened? He says, I don't know. I turned on the radio and found out I was fired.
Oh, no.
So I don't know what was up with Stan. I guess he probably found out that Kenny was available and he wanted to play with him, and he just did it that way. You know?
Hey, talking about the jazz circuit in those days, you know, obviously it's very different now. What can you compare today, especially to
well,
what it was
just
like?
The road has gotten much farther away. It used to be you could get in a car and cover the circuit. There was a jazz club in all the eastern cities. There was, well, at that time, the club in Boston was the Hi-Hat, and later on it became Storyville was where everybody played. But we played at the Hi-Hat that first week that I was with Stan. And then there were three clubs, I think, in Philadelphia, any one of which you might book into for a week. And there was one in Baltimore and one in Washington and one in Toronto. Well, there were two clubs in Toronto, actually, but this one club was the one where we usually played.
Pretty much any decent-sized city was going to have at least one good club.
We would go to Detroit and once in a while Milwaukee. But that was pretty much the Eastern Circuit, you know.
And you
once
could do that
in a rare while, Montreal.
And you could do that by car.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It was all done by car. When I went on the road after Stan fired me, he wanted to get Teddy Kotick back, who had been his original bass player. Teddy had been working with Claude Thornhill's band, so I went and took that job. And I did a summer of one-nighters with Claude, and we were driving cars. There was no bus. So
wow.
We went all the way from, I joined the band in Erie, Pennsylvania, and I left the band after having been all the way to El Paso, Texas, and a week or two in New Orleans, and back in West Virginia, I think, was when Claude announced that he was going to just be doing weekends for a while. And I had gotten an offer from Terry Gibbs to play with his quartet. So I jumped ship from Claude's band and joined Terry and went back on, you know, doing the Eastern club cycle a week at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And then Terry went to California, and I was just doing things around New York when Marion McPartland had a trio at the Hickory House. It was a steady gig, and Vinnie Burke was her bass player, and he was leaving. And I had met her on a concert where Terry's group played with Mama Jamal and Marion's trio, and she liked the way I played, so she called me up and asked me to come and work there at the Hickory House. That was my first good, steady in-town job. I stayed there a couple of years.
Oh.
Joe Morello was the drummer.
Most of our listeners probably know Marion McPartland from her great NPR show.
Oh, yeah. She did that so well.
But she, for those that don't know, she was an active player in her time.
Oh, yes. Well, she had that job at the Hickory House for, oh, 5 or 6 years, I guess. I did a little over 2 years with her, and then Jerry Mulligan called me to join his sextet, and I couldn't resist a chance to play with Brooke Meyer and Zoot Sims and Jerry. So
yeah.
I went with him for about a year, and then after that finished, I went back to the Hickory House for another year and a half, I think it was, but Morello had already left to go with Brubeck, so Dick Scott was the drummer then. And then we went out on the road one summer, and we were supposed to work about a month in a couple of different hotels out in Indiana. And she got word while we were playing in Columbus, Ohio, that the hotel chain had been sold and the new owner didn't want any music. So that really messed her up. She'd already sent in a sub for the rest of the summer at the Hickory House.
Oh, no.
And so the trio just broke up. She went to Chicago to visit her daughter-in-law, and I went back to New York. And even though we played occasionally after that, I never was a member of her group again. Mulligan came up with some more work. I did a lot more work with him, different quartets with Bob Brookmeyer and another quartet with Art Farmer, and then the Concert Jazz Band, as long as that lasted. That was really a nice band.
The Concert Jazz Band, what was that?
Jerry Mulligan.
Oh, Jerry Mulligan's. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. He made a little money in the movies, and he invested it in getting a book and equipment for a big band. And he had a nice deal with Norman Granz. They went, they did a tour of Europe. The rhythm section then was Mel Lewis and Buddy Clark on bass, and Connie Condoli was in the trumpet section. The rest of the guys were New York players, and they did a tour of Europe featuring Zoot as a guest soloist. And then when they came back to New York, Jerry announced that he was going to stay on the East Coast, and Mel Lewis decided to stay in New York, but Buddy Clark and Connie Condoli wanted to go home, so Jerry hired me and Clark Terry to replace them. And then that was the band until he had a deal with Norman Granz at that time, that Norman would pick up the losses in this country if he could have the tours of Europe and the recording. But then Jerry got word after I'd been with the band for about three, four months, I guess. Jerry got word from Norman that he was selling Verve Records and that the deal was off. And Jerry looked at his schedule and said, "Geez, I got a month here with no work for the big band. I can't keep these guys on salary until the next job in Boston." You know, so he broke up the band. and went back to working with the quartet with Brookmeyer. And about we would rehearse regularly with that band just because we all liked it.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be like maybe twice a year we'd do a week or two at Birdland and then maybe a record date. And that was the way the band finally died. It just ran out of work, you know.
Like for so many other big bands, I mean, it's such after the advent of rock and roll and the change of cultural tastes, it's just
yeah.
been harder and harder to keep those big units together.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing, in the days when there were so many big bands, and, you know, whether or not they were jazz bands, they all drew audiences because everybody was dancing in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And there were lots of ballrooms, and the idea of having just a jazz band in a club was something that, I guess they started that when in the war years when Count Basie went into the famous store, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm.
On 52nd Street. But, you know, we played Birdland and the Vanguard, places like that, with Jerry's Big Band, and always packed the joint. Everybody loved the band, but it just was not economically feasible anymore. The bands weren't that popular that they could really draw huge crowds, you know. I mean, the Rock and Rollers were filling arenas with thousands of people.
Yeah. That must have been frustrating. Yeah. So for younger listeners, you know, why is the quartet and the quintet, you know, the standard setup for a jazz group? Well, it wasn't always. A lot of it just has to do with pure economics.
Yeah. Right. A lot of the jobs I do today are either duos or trios, just because that's as much as they can afford to pay.
Hey, well, let's talk about some of the stuff you're doing these days.
Well, I've sort of retired back to jazz. I was doing Broadway shows for quite a while, and I would take off to do jazz jobs, you know. But there's a couple of younger musicians now that have discovered me and like the way I play. So I play out in Brooklyn at a Thai restaurant with this Japanese trumpet player friend of mine. Ryo Sasaki is his name. And he usually has a good guitar player, either Andrew Lim or Greg Ruggiero, or there's a couple other guys that play very well. And there's also a couple of clubs in the Village in Soho where he is able to sell a group now and then. And
what's
then there's a 12-piece band that I play with about once a month down at the garage in the Village. A guy named Lou Caputo runs that band.
Is that the famous garage in Soho, or is it a different place?
It's on Sheridan Square. It's in the Village.
Oh, okay.
It's funny, when I first came to town, that space was called the Village Nut Club, and they had comedy bands in there.
Oh, okay.
And then when that closed, in the 50s there someplace, they made an off-Broadway theater there.
Mm-hmm.
And there were three or four different theaters, different names, you know, but it was always a theatrical space. And then just a few years back, somebody, the new owners, bought this place to turn it into a restaurant. And fortunately, they made a jazz room out of it. But when they tore down all the old signs on the outside of the building, worked into the brickwork over the door, it said garage, which is what the space originally was, I guess.
Uh-huh.
So to save themselves having to buy a new sign, they just called it the garage.
Well, I think, you know, speaking of economics, I think that, in fact, I know that the city taxes people based on the size of their sign and whether it hangs out in the street or not, and the
uh-huh.
can be quite high, so I could see the economy there. Where's the gig in Brooklyn? It's a Thai restaurant.
Yeah, a place called Sage. It's out on Graham Avenue in Williamsburg.
Great. And what night's that show?
I'm there almost every Friday night. Ryo has the band Fridays and Saturdays, I think, but I'm in the Friday band.
So I know that Brooklyn's become sort of the new place where young players can get opportunities to get exposure.
Yeah.
get practice and meet each other, and that's so important because Manhattan's pretty much, well, for the most part, white tablecloth and, you know, big cover, and it's a little hard.
Yeah,
to
well, it's not. I mean, there are those places, but there's one place on 8th Street between McDougal and 5th called the Analog, which is like a wine bar.
Uh-huh.
And the owner likes jazz, so Rio is able to sell him a group for a couple times a month, usually on a Sunday. And it's amazing how many interesting musicians come by. There's a couple of good bass players come and sit in, a good alto player, and once in a while a drummer comes by with a couple of drums and adds. We usually don't use drums on that job, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a good keyboard player has made it with us a couple of times, and they're all like in their 20s and 30s, you know. So
and I'm guessing that they're all coming from now these days from academic programs, you know. In other words, there are no big bands where they can tour, and I don't think a lot of young musicians are joining the military, and no one's being drafted anymore.
But there's still a lot of interchange just on the street, you know, guys dropping by each other's apartments to play and or finding jam session spaces somewhere, you know. And so even though a lot more people now have gone through academic programs teaching jazz, they didn't exist when I was coming up, so we had to do something else, you know.
Yeah. I remember when New School started its program, and I thought, "What? A degree in jazz? Don't you just learn it?" And you know, but I think it's a good thing. Last time I counted, believe it or not, there are over 600 programs in the country now, and it's good because it's employment for musicians on the faculty.
Sure.
Well,
it's just like Art Barron called me to do a thing up at Jazz at Lincoln Center the other day. They had, it was like a lunch and seminar. It must have been about 25 or 30 young people who had graduated from jazz programs and were going out to teach.
Oh.
And they wanted to meet some older musicians and talk to them about questions they had to ask, you know. So Art put together, he got Dakota Staton's older brother, Fred Staton. I think he's 100 now and still plays great tenor.
Really?
And Bernard Purdy came and played drums. And, Zeke, I can't think of his last name, good piano player. It was a whole nice afternoon. And we played, and then some of them sat in and played with us, and we sat around and answered whatever questions they had to ask. You know, it was a nice idea.
My impression is that the art form is alive and well. And you know, I'm remembering back late 70s, early 80s. Maybe it was just my impression at the time, but it seemed like, wow, is this going to make it? Is there going to be jazz? Where are the new players going to come from?
There's a whole generation out there. You know, I always, somebody says to me, like, you think jazz is dying? And I said, do you think chess is dying? It's a great game. Somebody's always going to want to play it, you know?
Oh, that's great. That's great. Of course, yeah. Yeah. Hey, let's talk a little bit about your books. How did you discover that you were a writer and wanted to take on the task of creating
books? I'd been interested in writing since I was in high school. I used to write for the high school newspaper, and I did well in my English classes and things like that. And I wrote a couple of articles even for Downbeat in those days. So I'd been writing, you know, occasional stuff. I did after I went to Russia with Benny Goodman's band in the 62, I think about 10 years later, Gene Lees asked me to write about our experiences there. And I did a very long article for his jazz letter.
Uh-huh.
And it kind of got me back into the swing of writing again. I hadn't done anything for a while. And then I got involved with Local 802 with ran for the executive board, and we got a whole new administration there starting when John Gleisel became president in about 1980. And John asked me if I would like to do a column for the paper, and I said, yeah, I know exactly the column I want to do. Everybody's always sitting around in the band room telling stories about each other, and somebody always says, somebody should write these down. And so I said, let me be the guy who writes them down, and we'll put it in the paper every month. So I've been doing that for over 30 years now, and I haven't had to go looking for stories yet. They just keep coming in. Anything funny that happens in the music business, I hear about it.
Okay. Well, that's great. So you're in a good spot.
Well, that was really how I got started with the Jazz Anecdotes book, was one of the senior vice presidents at Oxford University Press, Sheldon Meyer, was a jazz fan, and he had accumulated several jazz writers for Oxford, and then he was thinking that since they had published anecdote collections from the military and from opera and from literature, it would be good to do one from jazz. And he asked all his writers who would be a good person to do that, and they all pointed at me because of my column. So that was what got me into doing the first book.
Got it. Yeah, I was wondering, because Oxford University Press is normally a tough nut to crack for a writer.
Yeah.
That's a pretty primo imprint to have on your writing.
Yeah, well, while Sheldon was alive, he convinced the people in England that they could make some money selling jazz books, and I think they did.
That's good. You know, that trip to Russia sounds amazing. I guess in those days, of course, it was the Soviet Union. That was pretty much the height of saber-rattling.
Yeah, Khrushchev was in power then, and this was a crack in the iron door there. They thought that if they sent an American band over there, that it would be a good cultural exchange, you know.
And I corresponded with some of our subscribers who, there was one guy in particular, I remember his father was a jazz fan and I think even player in Russia, and they had to hide their rehearsals, they had to hide their records.
Yeah.
It's not something they could do publicly. I mean, it was serious. It was pretty scary.
Well, they had the Voice of America that got through there on shortwave, and Willis Conover had a program that played a lot of jazz and sent it behind the Iron Curtain. But, yeah, a lot of the guys we met, we found out that they had been able to record jazz off the air, but they couldn't get blank recording discs, so they punched holes in X-ray plates and used that. used those. And it was hard for musicians over there. Like, I met a bass player who, because he wasn't affiliated with an official orchestra anywhere, he couldn't get parts, you know, couldn't get strings and bridges and things like that. So he was using old harp strings on his bass.
Wow.
So I sent him a bunch of stuff when I got back to the States.
Wow, that's dedication on his part, huh?
Oh, yeah. There was an alto player that came up to Phil Woods and handed him his horn and asked him to tell him what he thought of it. And Phil looked at it and he said, what kind of a mouthpiece is this? And the guy says, I carved it out myself. And Phil tried to play it and he couldn't get a sound on. He just shook the guy's hand and he said, congratulations. And,
but, wow, and that's not the reed he carved. He carved the whole mouthpiece. Oh, my God. Unbelievable. What kind of crowds did you play to? What were the venues? And how did you get to
Well,
talk to
them? The first concert that we played in Moscow was in a huge auditorium, and we had been led to believe that there would be a lot of jazz fans there that would be glad to see us, you know. And the very first crowd was very tepid, polite scatterings of applause. Of course, Khrushchev was there for the first half of the concert. But then we realized that these were all politicians that were in the first crowd. You know, if you couldn't get a ticket to this wonderful concert, you weren't very powerful in the party, I guess. So it took a couple of 3 days before some of the real jazz fans started to get there, and then we got the kind of reception we had expected.
They must have been thrilled out of their minds.
Yeah.
I mean, to see Benny Goodman and the orchestra. Was it an orchestra or a small group?
No, it was a full band.
Wow.
We had, four trumpets, three trombones, five saxes, four rhythm. Joyce Sherrill was a featured singer. Two piano players, Teddy Wilson and John Bunch were both there.
I mean, kind of like the experience you had growing up in Kirkland. You know, you had the records, but you didn't know what it looked like was being done well. Wow. Hey, there's so many anecdotes, but since one of your books is about anecdotes, give us a good one. Or tell us one that you like in particular, if you will.
Oh,
there was a lot of them.
I always appreciated Al Cohen's sense of humor. He was very hungover one day on a tour in Italy, and somebody said, "Hey, Al, how you feeling this morning?" He says, "I feel like a million lira."
For young people, that was not a whole lot of money.
One time I ran into Al out in front of Charlie's Tavern, and he said, "What are you doing, Al?" He says, "Oh, I just finished a record date with 26 mandolin players." I said, "Where did you find 26 mandolin players?" He says, "All I know is all day today you couldn't get a haircut in Jersey City." He was a very funny man.
Yeah. Who was your, did you have a favorite musician or a handful of people that really just moved you and inspired you most?
Well, as a bass player, the first guy that I really, I mean, I had been listening to good bass players on record for years without ever thinking that I would be one myself. So I had admired Jimmy Blanton and Israel Crosby and people like that, that you could hear well on records, you know. But when I started first playing the instrument and looking around to see what other people were doing, Oscar Pettiford was around town, and I thought he was probably the best bass player I ever heard. And I was very impressed with him. And then Ray Brown was around, and Percy Heath, and Al McKibben, and a lot of good players. Red Mitchell was around. Red was an interesting case. I think he had a little bit of TB, and his doctor told him to stay out of nightclubs in smoky places for at least a year, you know. So he spent most of that year playing over at a friend's house, and he developed a technique of playing, since he didn't have to play loud, just pressing the strings instead of pulling them, and several different finger techniques that he developed. And he had a wonderful mind for improvisation. So with the new way of playing, he was able to articulate a lot of things that bass players hadn't been able to because they were busy trying to make themselves heard, you know.
Okay, and, sure.
So when he came back into the clubs, he was playing this new way. And, of course, unless he had a microphone, you couldn't hear him. He was playing very softly. But if you could hear what he was playing, it was brilliant stuff. And, of course, within a year or two, they started to develop pickups for the bass and amplification so that you'd be able to hear what the bass player was doing. And he was always a very special player for me.
So, Bill, the name of your newest book is From Birdland to Broadway, is that right?
Yeah.
And that's also on Oxford University Press.
Yeah.
And that's your personal, it's your memoir.
That's mostly my own personal experiences and character sketches of people I knew or worked with and the story of my life, you know.
Great. Well, I want to encourage everybody to check these books out, and I want to thank our guest, Bill Crowe, for sharing these very interesting stories about the jazz life before some of us were even born. And I think it's inspiring, and it's great to know and have the confirmation that, in fact, you know, the scene may have changed, but the passion among young musicians is still there. And by hook or by crook, they're learning the
and
music.
And there's really some fine young players out there. Well, when you stop and think about it, you know, when Lester Young and Charlie Parker and even Louis Armstrong were developing some of the best parts of their craft, they were very young men.
Yep, true. It's amazing how many, I think particularly in Chicago, but I know this is true in other places too, where you had really strong high school training. I always think of DeSable High School with Walter Diet, who was the band leader there. A lot of these guys would get their diploma, and a week later they're touring with Lionel Hampton, they were right into it. That kind of thing doesn't exist today, but again, you do have the academic programs. You may not have as many clubs, but you
have. Well, it's like I remember some years back, I was doing a festival a couple of days long down in Greenville, North Carolina. North or south, I can't remember which Carolina. Anyway, okay. I was playing with Red Rodney and Bill Watrous and Derek Smith and Ed Soff, and they had local jazz bands on the street corners around during that day. So I was walking around listening to these guys, and this one tenor player, he's a high school kid, just knocked me out. Listen to this kid. I said, why don't you come up and play with us on our concert tonight, you know? So he did, and he just blew everybody away. So Red Rodney said to him, well, if you ever come to New York, look me up, because I could probably use you. And he said, well, actually, I'm coming up to go to the new school next year. It was Chris Potter. And he came up to the new school, and I don't think he stayed there more than 2 or 3 months, where Red hired him and took him on the road, you know. And then his career just opened up from there on. He became his own band leader, you know.
Yeah, it's one field where it still is a meritocracy. If you can put it out there, you will find employment and you'll find opportunities. Well, Bill, thanks again. And again, I want to encourage everybody from Birdland to Broadway. We've been talking with Bill Crow, published by Oxford University Press. And really a pleasure talking with you. And I'm looking forward to hearing you at, the name of the place in Brooklyn again is?
Oh, Sage.
Sage, Friday nights.
Yeah, very good Thai food there.
We have a lot of...
And if you want to check out my website, it's BillCrowBass.com.
Oh, great. Thank you.
There's a lot of good photos there.
Great. So that's Bill Crow, and that's spelled the way you would spell Crow, C-R-O-W, BillCrowBass.com.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, Bill, thanks a lot.
Okay.